Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
My dudes.
We are so close to getting back to regular Endless Thread episodes.
True. T-minus 1 week.
Gah! Just gave me a small panic attack. We have a lot of work to do.
It'll be fine.
It'll be fine. It'll be great even. But in the meantime, we'd like to give you one more little tasty taste of some interesting things we've been up to.
Is this the last tasty taste before we return? Pretty much. And it's a good one. A few weeks ago, I interviewed Jon Favreau, the former speechwriter for President Obama, who makes a very popular podcast called Pod Save America.
Ben did this for a live audience at WBUR's new awesome event venue. It's called City Space. It's right here in Boston where we make the show. And if you like politics, specifically politics with a left-leaning perspective, which is where Pod Save America is coming from, you're probably going to enjoy this conversation. A lot to dig into here.
Definitely. But fair warning, yes, Jon Favreau, his co-hosts, and their show come from a perspective, and yes, we are going to get pretty wonky for about 40 minutes here. But also, hopefully fun and funny. Take a listen. Check, check. All right.
Here we go.
If you're, for some reason, confused and in the wrong place, this is Jon Favreau. Maybe you've heard of him. He hosts a very successful podcast, co-hosts a podcast called Pod Save America, and also is the founder of Crooked Media, a media and podcast company. Is that fair to say? Can I say it that way?
Would you say podcast company?
A media and podcast company.
Perfect.
Yeah, that works. Cool. I was going to ask you, like, you know, Venezuela, Sudan, a lot of big news stories happening right now.
Right.
But you're probably, the big story of the morning is probably Julian Assange, right?
Yeah, I've been trying to catch up on that before I got here.
No pressure. But he was arrested.
I always do the outline for the show the night before. So we have a show tonight in Boston.
Right.
Which did not have Julian Assange on it. So I
won't. But it will now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question going, I mean, there had been, thanks to some leak in D.C., people had known that there was sealed charges against Julian Assange as far back as November. And I think the question a lot of people had was, are they going to indict him for publishing stolen information, which is technically against the law, but something that prosecutors have in the past let go because they don't want to chill press freedoms, or will they find something else to indict him on that will not necessarily chill press freedoms? And it does seem like what they've indicted him for is helping Chelsea Manning hack, or basically offering to help Chelsea Manning hack into computers to steal the information, which, you know, is a more solid charge in terms of press freedoms, though since he didn't succeed in helping her hack,
right.
I don't know how strong the case is that the prosecution necessarily has against Assange. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah, and I guess in some ways it's the reason that he's finally been yanked out of the consulate is partly because his relationship with his landlords has gone south.
Yes, finally. No, but I saw Senator Mark Warner of Virginia said this morning, like, however Julian Assange started, whatever he thought he was doing when he started WikiLeaks, what he has become is an agent of the Russian government.
Right.
And tried to help them interfere with our elections and also, you know, subvert Western democracy.
Can you talk a little bit about the Democratic majority in the House?
Yeah.
And just, I don't know, I'm not necessarily asking for a scorecard, but like, where are you, what interests you about what the, you know, the Democrats are doing in the House right now? And what are they failing at, in your view?
Yeah. So I think Nancy Pelosi has a very tough job, because when you look back to 2018 and why we won and how we won, this was not some like liberal progressive supermajority that swept into the into Congress, right?
Yeah, I was going to say we won.
Yeah, right. We did win. Landslide, right? Most seats that Democrats have picked up since Watergate.
But you wouldn't know it from some of the coverage, right?
Right. No, you would not know it. Once again, the coverage really nailed it. So, but a lot of these seats that we won were in very red districts. Yeah. You know, you had everything from winning safe seats and very liberal congresspeople winning safe seats that were Democrat through primary, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Yep. You have a bunch of Democrats who won districts that voted for Romney but voted for Clinton in 2016. And then you had some Democrats, a few of the House Democrats, win districts that voted for Trump but had voted for Obama in the past, and they came back to the Democrats. And so those last two categories of seats, you know, those people won their seats by talking about health care and the Republican attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act over and over and over again in their districts. They made the election about that issue, and that's why they're there, right? So these people, these representatives, when they get to Congress and they hear that, you know, Democrats want to do a bunch of investigations of Donald Trump, that they want to get the tax returns, that they want to possibly pursue impeachment, it gets them nervous.
Yep.
And it gets them nervous because they think, well, that's not what people in my district care about. They care about health care. They don't pay much attention to what's going on in Washington. They don't pay much attention to investigations and all that bullshit. They really care about, you know, what's going on with their lives, their wages, their jobs, their health care. And so I get that. But on the other hand, like, we now have a president of the United States who potentially committed a crime, multiple crimes. Federal prosecutors have already decided that there's enough evidence to say that he is an unindicted co-conspirator in a separate crime where he paid hush money to adult film actresses.
Right.
And a crime which we know is a crime because his Michael Cohen is going to jail for it and pled guilty to it.
Right, right.
And if Donald Trump was not a president, he very well probably would have been indicted as well. And now that we have a president who is, you know, he's down at the border. He's telling Customs and Border Patrol agents to refuse asylum and not listen to judges, to lock people up anyway. Hmm. He's got his Treasury Secretary telling the IRS
to not give up his tax returns,
even though the law says the IRS shall provide tax returns upon Congress's request of any taxpayers. It is
right.
As clear as possible in the law.
They're like, why are you here? You know, Treasury Secretary, why are you not supposed to do this? Right.
And then you've got, you know, his handpicked attorney general out there saying, yeah, maybe I will look into spying and all these conspiracy theories that Donald Trump has dredged up,
right.
Even though there's no evidence they occurred. And in fact, there's evidence to the contrary. So you have a president who is sort of assaulting norms, institutions, stepping up his attacks on the rule of law itself, potentially breaking laws himself. And I think the Democrats have to ask themselves, okay, we know that voters don't really care about these issues as much as they care about sort of economic issues that affect their lives.
Yep.
But what is the consequence of us just taking a pass and looking the other way as the President of the United States flouts the rule of law, potentially commits crimes, and we're not going to go after that, and we're not going to spend time on that, and we're not going to undergo impeachment hearings because we're afraid of the politics?
Right.
Because we're worried. Like, that might get you through the next election, but what kind of precedent does that set? What does that set for future presidents? What does that set for this president? Because the more he knows he can get away with this stuff, the further he's going to push the envelope. We've already seen that. He's also out there last night calling Democrats treasonous. Treasonous for starting the Mueller investigation, which they didn't do. Treasonous. Treasonous for not agreeing with his immigration policy. I mean, you know, it's not like winning the House in 2018 has checked his behavior in any way.
Right.
And the only reason the only way we can check his behavior is if the House uses the power that the voters gave them. And sometimes you have to do stuff that isn't necessarily politically easy, even though you have to do what's right, you know, and you have to think about your obligations to the Constitution and the rule of law.
So what I'm hearing, and forgive me, we are at the beautiful WBUR city space, and I am a public radio journalist, but also at least a fan of the pod. So what I hear you saying is that Democrats have to eat a shit sandwich, and that
they've been eating them for years.
Right, right.
They are connoisseurs of shit sandwiches in the Democratic Party. We ate them all through 8 years of the White House. They're like, served them at the mess every day.
One of your kind of live Q&As that you did with listeners recently, you guys talked a little bit about Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
And
my favorite people.
Yeah. And how he's just this kind of linchpin, even looking forward at 2020 and trying to figure out sort of how the Democrats win. And obviously, I think everyone here probably knows that your show comes from a pro-Democratic perspective. It's a progressive show.
We're on the fence.
How should we be thinking about the Senate? Because that seems like incredibly important.
Incredibly important. I think we think about it enough.
Yeah.
The Senate is probably, you know, if there were no Donald Trump, if it had been just a traditional Republican president, the Senate would probably be the biggest obstacle in the country to progressive change right now.
Yeah.
So what's the reason for this, right? Like, the Senate has always been an anti-majoritarian institution,
right?
From the very beginning. That's the whole idea. Wyoming gets two senators and so does California, right? That by itself isn't the problem we're facing right now.
Okay.
The problem is we have had geographic polarization over the last couple decades, meaning that we are now partisan by where we live in a way that we hadn't before. Mm. So urban centers are Democratic and liberal, and rural areas are much more conservative, and then the suburbs are the battlegrounds. But now you're seeing things like, you know, voters in Houston, in Phoenix, in Jacksonville, in Atlanta have much more in common with voters in Boston and New York and Los Angeles than they do with the people in the rural areas of their own state. And because of that, now all the states that are sparsely populated in the rural areas are deep, deep red states for Republicans. And the states that have a lot of population are deep, deep blue states. And that wasn't always the case before we sort of moved along these geographic lines,
right,
for polarization. So therefore, there is no scenario within the next 2, 3, 4 elections where the Democrats could ever capture 60 votes in the U.S. Senate, which is just a hard thing to understand. And that is if we run the table on every competitive seat that is up.
Speaking of tough sandwiches.
Yeah. And so this is why, because everyone's like, why are you suddenly become so obsessed with the filibuster, right? Like,
right.
It's a weird fetish for me. I realize that.
Go on.
But the problem is, there's just no path for us to get 60 votes in the Senate. And, you know, aside from that, there used to be a universe where there were moderate Republicans.
Right.
Even when probably not by the time Obama got to the presidency, but I remember when I was in the Senate with him, you know, he worked with Dick Lugar from Indiana on nonproliferation. We worked with an extremely conservative senator from Oklahoma, Tom Coburn, on ethics reform. We don't have that anymore. We don't have Republicans in the Senate that are willing to work with Democrats or anything. Maybe Susan Collins once in a while, maybe Lisa Murkowski once in a while,
right,
on certain issues. But that's about it. And so when I talk to all these presidential candidates, you know, a lot of them are proposing very ambitious policies, which is great. I think I happen to believe we need a lot of ambitious policies because, you know, economic inequality is at levels we haven't seen since the Great Depression. And yet, what I want to know from them is, well, what are your plans to get this passed? Because if even if we run the table in the Senate in 2020, which will require the following. Doug Jones is up again in Alabama. That is going to be a very difficult seat to keep. So let's go worst case scenario. Let's say we don't keep Alabama. We need to then flip four Senate seats for Democrats to win. We have Arizona, which is tough but doable. Colorado, which we should definitely flip.
Yeah.
We don't flip Colorado. We have huge problems. Maine, which, you know, we should be able to flip, but Susan Collins is very, very popular up there. And
well-established.
Well-established, so it could be very hard. And then we have to flip either Iowa, North Carolina, Georgia, or Texas, which are all very, very, very tricky.
Right.
And so even if we do those, say we flipped all of them and Doug Jones kept the seat, we would not be near 60. And then the question is, you have 55, 56 seats in the Senate, and you got either President Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or Joe Biden or whoever.
Right.
And they're saying Medicare for all, Green New Deal, blah, blah. None of that's getting through if you have the filibuster in place. It's just not.
Right. So how do you deal with that? I mean, how bummed out are you?
I mean, I'm
you're talking about this stuff all the time, and right now I hear you saying, like, it's never going to happen, at least in the next, I think
eliminating the filibuster could be possible. Like, I mean, okay. my hope is that we get 51 seats in the Senate, or 50 seats in the Senate, and then the tie is broken by the vice president.
Right.
And, you know, we have a president, at least, who is pushing for the elimination of the filibuster. But the reason I think this is so important, the bigger reason here, is what I have come to realize is that when Democrats get into power, we are the party that tells people government has the capacity to make a positive difference in your lives. And if we don't do that when we're in power, if we can't actually pass the policies that we talked about on the campaign trail, what that does is it deepens people's cynicism in politics and government.
Right.
It makes people think that their politicians say a lot of stuff on the campaign trail and then don't actually mean it when they get into office.
Mm-hmm.
And then that cynicism turns into apathy and indifference, and people start participating in politics. And that kind of cynicism, that's fine for the Republican Party, because their philosophy is government can't run a one-car parade, and everyone should be on their own, and everyone should just live their own lives, and we don't care about government that much. So when people don't care that much about government and politics, it redounds to the conservative sort of free market ideology. It really hurts Democrats and the progressive ideology. And even going back to the Affordable Care Act, one of our biggest issues with that was, you know, we passed the Affordable Care Act in 2010, and it doesn't really become fully implemented until years later, and it's not popular until 2017, basically, 7 years later. Then it's finally popular because people start to feel the benefits, and the Republicans try to take it away, and now the ACA is very, very popular. But next time Democrats get into power, we need to start passing programs and policies that have an immediate effect on people's lives.
Also, make sure the website works.
And make sure the website works. Use Squarespace.
This talk is sponsored by Squarespace. No, this podcast is not sponsored by Squarespace, but it should be. You guys, we're just sitting by the phone.
Right here.
We're right here.
Call us up.
All right. Anytime.
We're free.
Still waiting. All right. We will be right back in a minute.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Can you talk a little bit about how you guys are going to talk to every single Democratic candidate, even with the number of shows you put out? Because there's, I think there were like 10 more this morning. That's not true, but it
probably
feels
another
that
five
way
while we're speaking. Right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, exactly.
Just coming out of the woodwork.
I mean, is that a problem?
Unclear. We don't know yet. I think. Look, there are definitely benefits and drawbacks to having everyone who's ever registered as a Democrat running for president.
Today I'd like to announce, but no.
Yeah, right. I think on balance, it is a good thing for the party that we have this many people out there talking about the issues we care about, getting people excited, and you know, the one thing about this field is I've never seen a field that is so diverse and so talented. Mm-hmm. You sometimes have a few stars at the top, and then a bunch of people where you're like, why are they running?
Right.
I think you have 5, 6, 7, 8 candidates who all have some really, really excited supporters and followers. And mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing. We are going to try to interview every single candidate. The way that we're doing it is basically how the DNC is doing it. The people who get 65,000 donors or are at 0 to 1% in the polling, we're going to try to have on the show.
Archetypes? Any archetypes right now among the candidates? Dark horse, darling, front runner, heir apparent? I don't know.
Here's the way I look at the field right now. I think Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders you have to call them front runners.
Yep.
I don't think they're not quite traditional front runners in the sense that I don't think their leads are overwhelming.
Yeah.
Although
but they're running against a pretty untraditional president, potentially.
That right? is correct. Although I don't think that their leads are just about name ID either.
Fair.
At this point, I think it's some about name ID. But, you know, there was a poll out from California Democrats. And, of course, you know, Kamala Harris's name ID in California is got to be very,
massive.
Very, very high.
Massive. Yeah.
And Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders still had their leads in that state. Mm. So they're front runners, but they both have their issues as well. So I don't think they're strong, strong front runners.
Yep.
And then I think you now have a pack in the middle, a tier in the middle, that's Kamala, Warren, Beto, Buttigieg.
Yep.
Maybe right beneath that is like Booker and Klobuchar.
Okay.
And that seems to me that's how the field looks to me right now. And then there's a whole bunch of people below them who may not stay below them either, right? Like this, nothing would surprise me
right.
in this primary at all.
Right.
And I mean, you know, a couple months ago, no one really knew who Pete Buttigieg was. And now he's
the new hotness.
Yeah, now he's the new hotness. And so could that happen to some of the other candidates who are currently polling at 0, 1, 2%? Possibly. And there's a whole bunch of candidates who still aren't in the race yet.
You guys recently interviewed Buttigieg, and I think soon after that, there was a piece in Current Affairs that was pretty unflattering, and I only read part of it, but it was essentially at least...
It was very long. I couldn't get through it all. I'll be honest.
It was very long. what do you think about that piece? What's your reaction? I mean, the biggest criticism that I saw in the piece was essentially like... when you ask him about policy, he's like, oh, we're too focused on policy, but he doesn't really have any policy. That was kind of the argument being made in the section that I read. But how are you feeling about him as a candidate and especially after reading part of that piece?
It's been very cool to watch. I met Mayor Pete about a year ago.
Okay.
And he came to LA and we had coffee. Mm-hmm. And
what was his haircut like then?
The same.
Okay.
Same.
Will it get better?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know.
Fair.
But it's funny because when I met him, I recognized him. And he was like, yeah, the last time I saw you, it was during the 08 campaign in Chicago. And yep. I was doing a stint at the DNC
yep.
as a staffer. He's like, and we were at some party together. And I was like, oh, that's where I know you from. And we had this great chat. And I liked him a lot. But I'll be completely honest. I left that chat not having an inkling of an idea that he would ever be a presidential candidate.
Mm.
But I do think he is... I think what has excited people about him is he is super thoughtful, mm-hmm. particularly in diagnosing some of the problems, especially structural problems that we've had in politics and basically some of the framing that has been done about the Democratic Party basically by the Republican Party, right? And mm-hmm. so he talks about freedom in a different way and he talks about community in a different way. And so I think he's been very adept at sort of diagnosing some of the problems that we face in politics right now, and particularly the Democrats face. Look, I think if he goes through the entire campaign like that and doesn't come out with any policies, then yeah, of course that criticism is valid.
Yep.
But it is April
right.
of 2019, and I can remember being on the Obama campaign at this time.
Right.
And the knock against us was... Barack Obama has no policies. It's all hope and change. It's all platitudes. Right. Hillary Clinton's rolling out a policy every new day. That's the way to win this thing. And Barack Obama's never going to go anywhere.
How'd that work out?
Yeah, right.
Right.
But I will also say, and I think I said this on the pod sometime, I can remember an SEIU forum on healthcare early on.
Okay.
Around April of 2007. And Hillary Clinton goes out there and is brilliant and lays out her healthcare policy in detail. John Edwards goes out there, is very smart, has his policy all laid out. Barack Obama goes out there and speaks in platitudes and sort of big picture about what we need to do in healthcare. And he came off that stage and was like, I never want to be that unprepared again. And I'm mad that I don't have this stuff ready. But I do think these candidates need their own policies. You want to put your own stamp on the debate we're having, the policy debate we're having. Elizabeth Warren comes out with a new policy every single day.
So this was going to be my next question, right? Elizabeth Warren, we're in Massachusetts.
This morning.
Right. Like Elizabeth Warren, like, you know, the gif of the cat mashing the keyboard. Like, I feel like that cat is writing for her Medium account. Her policies have really, she's been like putting them out. And she's got a ton of policy ideas. And I think at one point, at least a couple of years ago, I'll just say this anecdotally, a couple of years ago, like everyone I talked to was super pumped about her. And I guess that's kind of weird because that's when Hillary Clinton was running. I remember like a New Yorker piece about them meeting and the sort of strange theater of that for both of them. But just anecdotally, a lot of the people I talk to now are like not as hot on her.
Yeah.
And it seems like a lot of people point to her fight with Trump about her ancestry and how she handled that. So I don't know. Where do you think she's at in the race? And
yeah, so... I love Elizabeth Warren. I do not love her just because she puts out a ton of policy.
Mm-hmm.
I like her because she is incredibly wonky, but when she talks, she turns all that wonk into a very compelling narrative about what's wrong with our economy and what we have to do to fix it.
Yeah.
And she has stories that she tells that goes with it. And by the way, she has a strategy for how she's going to get this stuff passed.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely do not subscribe to the Elizabeth Warren rolls out a policy every day, and yet the media hates that. And so that's why she's not winning. Like, no. And that's not the reason that I'm really compelled by her. I'm compelled by her because she is a very compelling speaker. Mm. She has a theory of the case. She has a message. She has policies to back that up. And then she has a strategy to achieve those policies. So why is she not leading the field right now? It's possible that the fight with Trump had something to do with that. But I think we forget that before that fight with Trump, she was a Democratic Party. She was like the boogeyman of the Democratic Party, along with Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama, and some of the other figures for a very long time since she first came into politics.
Kind of, and you mean by like forcing them left or just being...
Republicans decided nationally that they would run ads back in 2012, even before that maybe, that would include Elizabeth Warren because she was, you know...
Crazy.
She was scaring off Wall Street. Right. And I've met, you know, I've met Democrats since now the Democratic Party has a bunch of rich finance people in it who are more socially liberal and fiscally conservative. And you talk to people on Wall Street and they are very scared that Elizabeth Warren is coming after their, you know, $100 billion profits. So I do think that that she has been, her name, when you look at the polls, her name ID is almost as high as Bernie's and Biden's, which is unusual for someone who has not run for national office.
So it's thanks to the Republicans.
It's the I think Republicans have been beating up on Elizabeth Warren for years.
Wow.
Not as long as, I mean, Hillary Clinton had the problem that Republicans have been beating up on her for like 30, 40 years.
Right.
Elizabeth Warren hasn't had that problem. But I do think, you know, there's a lot of people who, when they think Elizabeth Warren, they think of the person they've seen in some awful RNC ad or a Fox News segment.
Right.
I think that she is the candidate most likely to, well, there's a couple like this, but when people meet her in person, and Iowa is the perfect state for that, and I think that's why she's invested a ton in Iowa, when people meet her in person, they're going to say, oh, that's not the Elizabeth Warren that I've heard about or read about. She's warm and she's compelling and I really like what she had to say. Like, I would wager that that's happening a lot on the ground in Iowa in a way that's not quite breaking through in the national narrative just yet.
Did you study classical piano as I read?
Wow.
In
deep dive.
Your college paper, former college paper.
I studied music theory. The first 2 years I was at Holy Cross.
Okay.
Because I had taken piano lessons and sort of played competitively all through high school. And so I thought that maybe I would do that in college. And then I realized I probably wasn't quite good enough to do that. And then I was also getting too interested in politics by my sophomore year of college.
Are there any similarities between like theory and speech writing?
Yeah, there's, I mean, I sort of learned this, I didn't really learn it, it just sort of happened when I was learning to write speeches, particularly for Obama, is that there is a rhythm that's important to speeches. And it's not, I guess it's something that you can be taught, but I wasn't, it just sort of picked it up. I mean, I remember like after the New Hampshire speech, which was the Yes We Can speech, a reporter reached out to me and was like, did you realize that some of that speech was in iambic pentameter? And did you plan that? And I was like,
yes, definitely.
And I was like, googling iambic pentameter. No, I did not plan that. So it's sort of by osmosis, but I think my music background probably helped in that regard.
Can you just briefly tell this story that I feel like is part of your story about this thing that happened, I think, backstage at the DNC with Unabomber Obama? So you had been working for John Kerry. You had been, as I understand it, actually collecting radio samples to provide to him. Is that right?
I was a press,
or his team?
I was a press assistant for a while, and that involved, you know, taking press calls, doing press clips.
Okay.
Part of it was something called radio actualities, which is getting sound from the candidate, and then you'd send that to like rural radio stations.
Oh, got it.
Just play it.
Okay.
It probably doesn't happen anymore.
Sure.
It was an Iowa thing.
And then you, you know, the campaign kind of faltered, and you, there was a dearth in speech writing talent, and you kind of stepped into that role for him.
Yeah.
Right.
They couldn't afford to hire a deputy speechwriter because the campaign was losing money and was maybe going to lose to Howard Dean.
Fair.
So they let me step into the role of.
They were like, hey, how about for no more money, do this now?
This thing has got a shelf life of a couple of months anyway, so let's give it a whirl.
So tell me about this thing that happens backstage at DNC.
So I was the deputy speechwriter. Chief speechwriter was on the road with John Kerry preparing for his convention speech. My job was to come to Boston and sit backstage and then make sure that all the speeches that were being delivered at the convention were on message with the Kerry campaign's message. So I was editing a bunch of people's speeches. And I get a call from the road from my boss, Josh Gottheimer, who's now a congressman in New Jersey. And he was the chief speechwriter. And he said, okay, there's a problem with the draft of the speech being delivered by State Senator Barack Obama. It's the keynote. And I'm like, what's the problem? I read over that speech. It's amazing, you know? And he's like, well, there's a line in that speech that John Kerry wants to use in his speech. And I was like, so? And he's like, well, he has to change it. And I'm like, okay. Well, again, why are you calling me? And he's like, well, we want you to ask him to change it.
Whoa.
And I was 21 at the time. So...
who's 21? All right. So you have to go to the president or the future president. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
So I walk down the hall and, you know, because apparently Obama is practicing his speech on teleprompter for the very first time. And I walk into the room and I see Robert Gibbs there. Mm-hmm. Robert Gibbs had been my boss in the Kerry campaign when I was press assistant. He quit during the shakeup and then went to go work for State Senator Barack Obama. And so I was like, oh, this will be easy. So I said, hey, Gibbs, I just got a call from the road. Can you tell him to change the line? And Gibbs is like, no. I'm like, I'm not telling him that. He's like, that's one of his favorite lines. He's like, you go tell him. So now Obama sees there's some commotion, and he's like, what's going on? And I introduce myself, and I walk up to him, and I tell him everything that I was supposed to tell him. And then he sort of like got up within an inch of my face, and he looked down at me. And I don't know what he said because I think I blacked out at that moment. Wasn't great.
So wait, is that because Kerry or his people read Obama's speech and then wanted to take a line?
This is the dispute.
Okay.
The Kerry people will tell you it just happened to be that both lines ended up in both speeches. The Obama people will tell you, no, no, no.
Right.
I don't know because the way that Josh said it to me was... there's a line in the speech he wants to use.
Right.
So who knows?
Does that work in college?
Yeah, right.
Interesting. So, okay.
So Obama was not happy. And then a man, a mustached man, came over to me and said, son, let's step outside and rewrite the line together. It was David Axelrod. It was the first time I met him. And so Ax and I step out into the hall and we rewrite the line. And all was well. And I thought to myself... well, it's too bad that I will never speak to Barack Obama again because I think that's a really fantastic speech. And then, you know, a year later when he sat down to interview me for the job, the interview went well because he did not remember it was me. And then fast forward a year later when I was in the Senate office, we were all sort of sitting around chatting and reminiscing and the convention speech came up. And Obama turned to Gibbs and he's like, do you remember that little shit who came up to me?
and you're
asked me to change the line. And I was like, that was me. And he's like, I would have never hired you. But and then he laughed so hard. He thought it was the funniest thing. Yeah. So he had a good sense of humor about it.
Trump, the way that Trump talks is really interesting to me. I'll put it that way. As a speechwriter, I would assume that you've thought about this a little bit. I've been really struck by the difference in video footage I see of the president and descriptions of how he speaks in private. I feel like the way he speaks in public is a very certain thing.
Yeah. But I don't...
Sorry, I don't know if that makes sense.
I guess I don't know how he speaks in private and how different that is. Mm. I mean, because you get all of this from sources, and I think the sources might make him sound smarter than he is. Mm.
Yeah, they're not directly quoting him usually. They're sort of describing an interaction or something. Yeah.
I'm most struck by, if you watch videos of Trump 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it does seem like he has clearly lost a step. You know, there was a video of him, one of his first interviews, I think he was being interviewed by Tom Brokaw, and he's talking about real estate on the Today Show. And he was very articulate. And now maybe it was because the subject is real estate, and that's the one thing he knows. But I just couldn't believe it was the same person as the guy we hear now, who now just walks up to the press corps outside the White House, and instead of saying hello, just goes, "No collusion, no collusion, no collusion."
Yeah, it's strange.
And it's also, I mean, as a speechwriter, you also, there's this funny thing where when he does have prepared remarks, and the few times he actually reads off prepared remarks, it does sound like he's reading a hostage statement.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems very uncomfortable, and it's not great delivery. And that happens with all public figures, right? The difference between reading prepared remarks and speaking off the cuff. That's why, you know, you try to memorize your remarks or you try to read off a prompter because that helps. And with Trump, it's particularly noticeable because Trump off the cuff, which is what we usually get, is so distinct that when he's forced to read like Stephen Miller's horrible writing, it very much feels like he is trapped and unhappy with that speech.
Cool. I was just curious about that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
Just really quickly, lightning round, Pod Save and Crooked Media. Why'd you create the company?
You know, part of it was obviously spurred on by Trump winning, and we thought we were retired from politics and, you know, Hillary Clinton would be president and we could all just ride off into the sunset.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen, so we felt like we really needed to be involved. But prior to Trump winning, you know, while we were in the Obama administration, Dan, Tommy, Lovett, myself, were all very big media critics,
yep,
as you can hear. And part of that critique was not even necessarily ideological or partisan. My belief is when you get to the end of watching the nightly news, you're oftentimes left feeling pretty helpless.
Yeah.
You just covered a lot of really tough problems in the world, really bad news. And because a lot of good news doesn't make the nightly news.
Yeah.
And just having all that wash over you and having this feeling of helplessness that you can't do anything about it, I think it feeds apathy, it feeds cynicism, it feeds all the things that hurt our politics. And as someone who cares about politics so much and cares about change and social change, I thought, wouldn't it be great to have a media company where you can diagnose the problem, but then also tell people, here's what you can do to change it, that you actually have agency to change the world around you, to organize, to become active. And that's sort of the basis for the company. And can we do it in an entertaining way so it's not just, you know, feeding people a bunch of boring statistics and information or having people yell at each other all day long. Everyone's like, well, don't you want to have a bunch of Republicans on? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I'd love to have conservatives on and have like an interesting conversation. I'm not interested in recreating a CNN panel where people are screaming at each other because you might call that bipartisanship. I don't think that's helping anyone.
Right.
Having people yell at each other. I'd rather have a thoughtful conversation with someone for 30 minutes on a podcast than scream talking points at each other for 5 minutes on cable. So that's sort of the fundamental idea behind the company.
I learned recently that maybe you guys picked the theme music for the show in part because of its similarity to the Top Gun theme song or the Top Gun anthem, which I then looked up and I was like, wow, this is really, it's not the same. It's not
very similar.
It's very similar. It's not a David Bowie, Vanilla Ice situation, but it is very similar. Is that true?
It's not because, no. We love it. Knew some people.
Can anyone sing it?
We're going to.
Can you sing it?
I'm not going to.
Okay. It's like, do, 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 something like that. Right.
And we had someone send us a bunch of potential theme songs, and we heard that one, and we're like, oh, this sounds great. And then the more we heard it, we're like, this kind of sounds like the Top Gun theme song. And we were like, well, we have a little podcast, so who cares?
Yeah.
And then just kept it. Now we love it.
It's great.
Oh, wow.
Give it up for this man here.
That was Ben talking with podcast radio host and speechwriter for President Barack Obama, Jon Favreau. And you should totally check out all of the Crooked Media podcasts if you like humor and politics and plain talk about politics. You can find Crooked Media stuff at crookedmedia.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And we are back, baby, next week.
Woo! Woo!
Yes!
Talk to you soon.